You're listening to the Men Overseas Podcast, a show that explores methods and ideas to help you live a bigger life. You will hear interesting stories of how people live, how they save and invest their money, and why having time wealth is better than being a billionaire. If you are entertained, educated, or elevated, be sure to hit the subscribe button. We're just getting started. Now here is your host, Brad D'Antonio.
Hello, you beautiful people listening. I'm glad you're here. We are still in Costa Rica, making the most of our October. My in-laws came to visit us here this past week, which was really cool because they had never been out of the country, except for they're from another country, not the U.S. But the only time they had left the U.S., other than to visit family in Mexico, they're from kind of near Monterrey. The only other time that they'd left the U.S. was to attend our wedding in May of 2018. So for them to have an opportunity to come spend a lot of time with their granddaughter in paradise, it was awesome. Of course, I invite all the grandparents to come visit us wherever we are in the world, but we're usually too far for them to just hop on a plane. But not this time. The San Jose Aeropuerto, San Jose is the capital of Costa Rica. You fly into San Jose if you're visiting the southern part. You would fly into Liberia if you're visiting the northern part of Costa Rica. But from airport to airport, Houston to San Jose, it's only 3.5 hours from Houston. And then we're another hour and a half, 2 hours drive from the airport in the southwestern direction. And if you're curious how long it would take to drive from here to Houston, I looked it up. Do you have any guesses? If you were to drive from Houston to Costa Rica, it would take 51 and a half hours, which makes you appreciate how far away from home you are when you put it in those kind of terms. And what's crazier still is anyone born before our grandparents, so like more than 99% of human history, they would have had to sail here. You know how long that would take? I looked it up too. To sail from the Gulf Coast, let's say you're leaving from New Orleans or Galveston, and you were to sail across what was then the Gulf of Mexico, that's what it used to be called, it'd take 10 to 14 days. So if you were a novice sailor who hadn't done many voyages, if you were no descendant of Magellan, do you know the story of Magellan? It's fascinating. It's one of those things you learn in school, but you're too focused on whether there's going to be a party at the Moon Tower on Friday night or a party at the Plateau. And by the way, as a longtime lover of music, this is something I've got to mention. The place where we partied in high school was called the Plateau, which we talked about once on this pod with one of my favorite guests ever, Lauren McAllister Andrews. We talked about it when she was on. The Plateau had sort of a theme song, especially during summer, because remember the Fresh Prince had that summertime jam where he said, "The place called the Plateau is where everybody goes." Well, that's where everybody went when I was in high school. And guys were out hunting and girls doing likewise, honking at the honey in front of you with the light eyes. You remember the jam. Imagine driving a Jeep in high school with the roof gone. Call it the J-Ride with a cobra snake over the spare tire, sitting up high like giraffe booty. Well, that was your boy providing the tunes at the Plateau, just jamming Toadies or Pearl Jam's cover of Crazy Mary. That was a song we'd all sing along to. We were too young to buy beer, but not too young to bend circumstances to your will and figure out a way to get a cold one in your hands anyway. Chase also had a convertible. We called it the Shark. And actually, I realize I messed up last week. I said that Matt Ory was the only guest I've had thrice. Chase has also been on thrice. That's more than two times. Yeah, his ride, we called it the Shark. And the reason why, it was a Chrysler LeBaron, and there was a little triangular piece of glass that sat up right next to his driver's side window, if you can imagine, envision what I'm talking about. It wouldn't go down, this little piece of triangular glass. It was broken. The glass wasn't broken, but it wouldn't go down when he put the top down. So it stayed up like a shark fin, just gliding down the highway. And the thought of getting it fixed, I don't even think that occurred to him or anybody. I don't think it would have ruined the theme, right? And we'd have had to give his car a new name. And we weren't going to do that. So plus we probably didn't have the money for that. And the other thing, and it gave it character. The other thing about the shark was the rear view mirror came unglued from the windshield. So it just dangled there. So he always had to hold it. We'd drive all the way to Austin, and I still have such fond memories of riding down Highway 290 with the top down, blue bonnets blooming on the side of the road. We probably had our shirts off, you know, most of the ride, if I had to guess. And we'd have to practically yell at each other to have a conversation because we're going 60 miles an hour with the roof down. And all the while, he's holding the rearview mirror in his right hand. And occasionally, he'd have to hold it up a little higher and turn it around so he could see what was going on behind us. So in a way, he was the Ferdinand Magellan of Sci Falls High School, navigating Texas highways with the old school technology. This was, of course, at the end of last century, and MapQuest wasn't even a thing yet. We didn't have cell phones. Well, he did, actually. He had one of those bricks you keep in the glove compartment that was intended for emergencies only. And many of us had pagers. And so you get a beep from Kim, and you know what she could do. But it had to be weighed as to whether or not that constituted an emergency. Or you wanted to find out which park are y'all playing basketball. Yeah, those are not emergencies. The 90s were different. That was a different time. Every time you'd use a phone like that in the 90s, one of those bricks in a leather case, with or without the Velcro, your parents would get stuck with a bill like you were calling one of those late night hotlines, those phone sex operators. You remember those? It'd be like, hello, I'm Ferdinand. And because you don't want to give your real name, right? And it'd be like, I want to say it was $9.95 a minute or something, which is probably $25 a minute in today's dollars. That kind of thing will be in a museum, like a sex museum someday, that little sliver of time in the late 20th century when you'd have to use a phone that connects to the wall and just talk to some fatty with a seductive voice. Isn't that something? I never called. And that's not something I did, but I was at a buddy's house one time, and I was going back to my hometown in Louisiana. This was the fall of 1994, and his little brother was calling one of those hotlines, just running up his parents' phone bill. I don't know about you, but just about every memory in my life I can associate with a song. Por ejemplo, for example, I mentioned the song As It Was last week. Well, the rest of my life, I'll associate that song with looking out at the Pacific from the balcony here in Costa Rica. And who named the Pacific Ocean? It was none other than Ferdinand Magellan. I don't know if that's his real name or not. Who names their kid Ferdinand, am I right? Anyway, that night we were in Louisiana when I went back to visit. We were jamming Buddy Holly. And that's the song I associate with that memory. Remember Buddy Holly by Weezer? So that first album drop from Weezer was in 94, and everybody loved that song. But the whole album was good, actually. You remember Say It Ain't So? And they had another one, Undone, the sweater song. You remember it started, hey, bro, how we doing, man? It's been a while. Life's so rad. You know, I've been to parts of the world where there are sex museums, which is, that's probably how the idea sprung in my head. Like in Prague, in the old town, there's a sex machines museum. And I've never gone in there. I pass it all the time. But I've been to the Museum of Prostitution in Amsterdam. And one of the things I learned there, so if you haven't been to the Netherlands, I'm sure you're aware, you've heard that Amsterdam has a bustling red light district, where ladies of the night are working throughout the day and night. But what are we going to call them now? Women who sell their souls for money. During the woke era, we called them sex workers, I guess because prostitute wasn't PC. I don't know. But how is sex worker better? Isn't that kind of like changing colored people to people of color? And that makes it all right? Well, from here on out, don't call me a podcaster. I am a person of podcasting. It's a little more dignified, more sophisticated. Speaking of museums, I think one day there will be a hallway in the Smithsonian devoted to the woke era. And our grandkids, they're going to think, well, what are they going to think, actually? I don't know. You know, if a large swath of the population right now believes themselves to be smarter and wiser than all those who came before them, like a true progressive, and they do think that, how much smarter are our grandkids and great-grandkids gonna think they are than us after walking the woke wing of the Smithsonian? Yeah, the difference is they'll be right. They will be so much smarter than us looking back. But in our defense, we did wake up in time to prevent a full communist takeover. That is, if we can, I mean, the fight is going to be constant. I mean, you have to ensure that Kami Mandani doesn't take the reins of power in the biggest city in America. That could be bad. Because I do think if he were to be elected, that would be the template for the Communist Party going forward. And you'll start to see more of them be more forthcoming about their beliefs. I think they'll shed the whole democratic socialist thing that they've been trying to sell us on for years and just call themselves what they are. Since this guy, this Mandani, he's flat out said he wants to seize the means of production and have government run grocery stores and free transportation for all the turnstile jumpers. And yeah, he's full blown communist. He admits it. And then I'm sure if he's in there, you and I will probably never visit New York City again because it'll be crime infested and cost prohibitive, frankly. Because I don't know if I've shared this story. All my life, my mom wanted to go to New York City at Christmas time. And in 2019, we did just that. We went up there around Christmas time. My mom, stepdad, my bro, his family, my wife and me, we all went to New York City. And we got to see the Christmas tree lit up at Rockefeller Center and all that. Well, you know where we stayed? The Roosevelt Hotel on East 45th Street. It's right next to Grand Central Station. If we went back this year and wanted to relive that memory and stay at the Roosevelt, we couldn't. We couldn't do that. You know why? It's because that wonderful hotel has been turned into a migrant shelter. So imagine if the compassionate communists take control of the city, they'd soon turn every hotel in Manhattan into a taxpayer-funded luxury shelter for third world migrants. Do you know how many hotels right now are being used for migrants? You're in luck. I have those numbers right here. 157 hotels are being used to house migrants, which amounts to about 11.5% of the city's total hotel rooms, which is 15,750 hotel rooms the taxpayer is covering for them every night. They must be so grateful. That's why we see all of their thank you notes circulating online. Not really. The latest Polymarket tally for Mandani to be the next mayor of New York is 88%. He is 88% likely to be the next mayor of New York City, and former Governor Cuomo is in second. I was talking about the Museum of Prostitution, which surprisingly has retained its name because, you know, maybe it was once called the Prostitution Museum and then was given the more dignified Museum of Prostitution. I don't know. But my biggest takeaway, what I remember most from the visit, is learning how long somebody spends in the room or behind the curtain, you know, once the sex worker closes the door and it's occupied, since we're talking about how long things take, right? I'll let you take a guess, since it's always more fun when you get to guess and see if you're right. How long does a man or lesbian woman, I guess, I'd like to see numbers on that. Is that a thing, a lesbian going to the red light district? And if not, why not? I don't know that either. But yeah, how long does it take does a person spend in there? How many minutes? Answer, 6. The average amount of time someone spends with a worker of sex is 6 minutes. Now go ahead, pat yourself on the back, young kings. Not for guessing right, because you didn't, but for now feeling like you should be on a Wheaties box for your 9-minute marathons. Where you at, girl? I keep weaving. I was going to tell you about Magellan, right? It's only fitting that I take the circuitous route to the story. So Magellan, he was from Portugal. He led the Spanish expedition to the East Indies. This was early in the 1500s. You know what I think about more often than I should? Whenever I say something like early 16th century, for example, I think about how many people we descend from. And there's no way to know, of course, because they didn't keep records. And because there weren't a lot of people sailing across the world, or even just sailing across the Gulf of Mexico, or even going on the other side of a mountain, typically. People didn't travel much before trains, planes, and automobiles. There was lots of inbreeding too, cousin marriages, and then that kind of thing. But if you put into AI, I like to use Perplexity for searches like this, assuming a generation is 30 years ago, although back then it was probably closer to 20 years, it'll tell you we descend from about 252,000 people. And the math would actually tell you we descend from millions of people, except the reality is that because of cousin marriages, many of our ancestors would repeat. So yeah, a lot of inbreeding, cousin marriages, that's going to lead to a single person, a single individual appearing multiple times in your family tree. Tell me if this sounds more like simulation evidence to you. In other words, were we born into somebody's video game or something's video game? As a follower of Christ myself, know that I only talk about simulation theory because I think it's fun and fascinating. But to the non-believer, the man who has no relationship with the divine, let's say, he might say that we're just software beings who create the past on demand to conserve computational resources rather than having a continuous past, that the universe is optimized for efficiency, and that we live in a reality that's just generated by our minds as much as external facts. So the mind would create more simplified subjective truths, quote unquote truths, in order to maintain our sanity and allow us to live in somewhat of a peaceful life. But under this premise, that simulation person might also say, the simulation believer, that we don't know where we came from and we can't find the end of this thing, lending credence to his argument that what exists in the far reaches of this existence hasn't yet been created because it hasn't been observed by us. But my question as it relates to this is, if we descend from so many people, how is it we have no idea where our ancestors are buried? If you just go back to the early 1800s, like early 19th century, it seems like we would know where some of these people are buried, right? Where they're laid to rest. So, for example, my dad's side comes from Sicily, which is an island just 4 miles from Italy. If you're looking at a map, it serves as the soccer ball that Italy kicks because Italy looks like a boot on the map. Well, did my grandfather never let the family know where his grandparents are buried on the island? An island that's just the size of New Hampshire or Massachusetts. It's not that big. My daughter already knows where my grandparents are buried in New Orleans. We talk to them every time we pass by. But I digress. Magellan, how fitting, right? Magellan is known for his inability to go from point A to B. Pretty sure I'm descended from him. But he was a Portuguese explorer who discovered the Strait of Magellan, of course, which is down near Patagonia, near the southern tip of Argentina and Chile. I went down there once. This was 2016. I was on a solo hiking trip in Patagonia, and I had plans to go down to Antarctica since I had been to all the other continents. But the weather was so bad that they canceled all the flights, and so I didn't get to go. But Magellan was the first Euro explorer to cross the Pacific and made the first known contact with the Philippines. And he was about 40 years old at this time, and when he got there, he messed with the wrong tribe. He attacked a bunch of Mactan warriors, and his crew was way outnumbered. There were about 1,500 of them, and Magellan had only 49 men. And it was a big miscalculation on his part because they found themselves too far from the beach during this battle, and they couldn't well use their muskets and their cannons to fight. So they started wading through waist-deep water, and the Mactans started spearing them in the legs. And Magellan was shot in the neck with a poisonous arrow, which killed him. So he died there in the surf in the Philippines after leading an armada across the Atlantic, and he dealt with terrible storms and mutinies, and he made it through what had to be terrible weather in Patagonia. When I was there, I was stuck in my log cabin for 4 whole days because of a snowstorm. You couldn't go outside because the winds were almost tornado winds. You couldn't even walk outside. And all I had to eat were protein bars. So I just sat and read and wrote and ate protein bars every 7 hours because I had to conserve what I had. But yeah, I can only imagine how bad he had to rough it. So they made it through South America and by way of the strait that now bears his name. He took a break. They went all the way across the Pacific, took a break in Guam, out in the middle of the world's most ginormous ocean, and then died on a beach in the Philippines, which it's called Mactan, and it's an island just east of Cebu, which is where the best VA on the planet resides. His name is Sats. Where you at, bud? Whenever I mention somebody here on the pod, I never know whether they'll hear their name or not. In this case, I am 100% certain my Philippine friend will listen to this, and he does the editing for me. He takes away all the ums and uhs, making me sound smarter than I am. Let's talk about money, or investing, actually. Much of the stock market has been carried by the coming AI revolution and all the optimism about AI's prospects. I would say the thing to be wary of that we don't know, or we can't know, is which companies are going to generate sustainable value for investors versus those that are being overhyped. As someone who's lived through the tech stock bubble of 25 years ago, I can tell you that at that time, leading up to the crash of the NASDAQ dropped 77% between March of 2000 and October of 2002. Was that 18 months? During that time, if you had said Amazon, the company that sold books online, was going to outperform Yahoo with an exclamation point, people would have thought you were nuts. And even if you held Amazon stock, let's say you purchased it in 99, you would have had to endure a 95% drop in the stock price. But there was no way that we thought Google was going to do better than Yahoo. Yahoo was Google at that time. And usually when you see somebody with a Yahoo email address, it's because that's where you got an email address in the year 2000, much like people to do now with Gmail. I still have my Yahoo email address that my girlfriend at the time created for me in the year 2000. My man overseas email is Gmail, but it was created in the 2010s. But yeah, my personal email is still Yahoo, and I'll probably have it forever. So the AI revolution is real, but there's a lot of uncertainty about which companies are going to win. Who's to say OpenAI isn't the Yahoo of 1999? We don't know. Which is just one of the reasons it's preferable to invest in ETFs versus individual stocks. Rather than trying to find the needle in the haystack, you could buy the whole haystack, as they say. Oracle's invested $300 billion. And much of it is borrowed to fund all the infrastructure needed to accommodate AI, which exposes them to all kinds of risk, just basic economic risk, if nothing else, with uncertainties in the economy being so heavily leveraged. And time will tell whether they're overreaching. They had a lot of overreach going on at the end of the last century. But Larry Ellison he's gotten himself into a highly leveraged AI arms race right now. And if it pays off, I imagine he'll be a trillionaire if he provides a lot of value to the rest of us. But if you wanted a more conservative investment approach, it'd probably be best to avoid AI hype altogether and instead maybe seek value in the broader markets and focus on companies that might benefit from AI without potentially being destroyed by it. But even there, you don't know if the banking sector will be aided by AI, or if the entire financial system will be overhauled, get a Jenny Jones makeover. my pawpaw was his favorite. He loved Jenny Jones when I was little. The last thing I'll say about the AI revolution is if you're dabbling in individual stocks, just be mindful there could be some emergent AI company that surpasses all of them. There could be a couple of 19-year-olds in a garage somewhere in Cupertino, California. They have online monikers like Big Sack, and they're building the next Meta or Google or whatever. And yeah, they're probably out there. 19-year-old whiz kids who've never known life before the internet, who maybe they first started learning large language models when they were 14, who are just obsessed with technology and lock themselves in a garage for four straight days, just surviving on protein bars like there's a big snowstorm outside. But as always, don't take investment advice from some podcaster. I haven't worn a tie in years. Don't take investment advice from me. That said, let's get an update from the best movie ever. Since I'm always talking about people lying to us, did you see Nancy Pelosi being asked whether she refused the National Guard on January 6th? Her response was, and I quote, "Shut up. I did not refuse the National Guard. The president didn't send it. Why are you coming here with Republican talking points as if you are a serious journalist?" You think she's telling the truth? Let's analyze her. The first thing you should know about lie detection is there'll never be one thing that's the giveaway. You're never going to have 100% certainty someone is deceiving you based on one thing that tends to be what people do when they lie. So the first thing you should know about what Nancy said is if somebody called you a rapist or a pedophile, how would you respond? You'd probably do something like, pff, or if you wanted to acknowledge the question, you might say, yeah, okay, dude, scram. But if God forbid you were one of those things, I imagine you'd either look at the ceiling a long time, kind of like Big Fanny's boyfriend did in Atlanta. Remember that when he was questioned about going to her cabin or something? Or you'd do what Nancy Pelosi did. So the first thing with Nancy, after telling the reporter to shut up, she said, "I did not." You catch that? Not using contractions is very much a tendency among liars. It's not how normal people talk. And in not using contractions, what they're doing is subconsciously trying to emphasize their innocence. And they're doing so with more authority and maybe formality. Whereas truthful people tend to speak more naturally, and we use contractions when we speak because there's no need to emphasize or overstate your innocence. And then she said, "The president didn't send it." So there she's referring to the National Guard as "it," which is interesting. That could be nothing, but, or she could be hung up on all this so much and drowning herself in vodka every day because she's so scared of potential consequences, seeing as now John Bolton's been indicted, along with Comey, Big Tish. A lot of them are being indicted. And in that sense, she could be referring to Trump's National Guard request, you know, maybe the email, or her sergeant at arms, I understand, was relaying the request. We can't know for sure. But if it turns out that that's her defense, then that'd be another hit for the lie detector, right? She may be using that as her defense soon. And then she attacked the reporter personally, saying that she's not a serious journalist. Well, in Nancy's world, a serious journalist is somebody who is a proven actress. They have some years of experience acting, who can regurgitate what Nancy says for dupes who live in the world that she's created, she and her ilk. You know, the imaginary world where the president colluded with Russia and said Nazis were fine people and foreigners came into the country by the millions through the southern border they said was secure because the climate was changing. They also flew them in, by the way, some 350,000 migrants to be distributed to the swing states. I wonder if they did like a carbon calculation on those flights, just like a cost-benefit analysis. Oh, socialists don't do those? No, of course not. If socialists understood economics, they wouldn't be socialists, right? It all makes so much sense in a world absent any logic or any coherent worldview. If you're born on Earth with darker skin, you truly want to risk life and limb to live in a country that is inherently racist, am I right? Where democracy is being destroyed. But what do people do when they don't want to rebut what you're saying? They attack you. They call you racist or intolerant or misogynist or unserious, evidently. But going back to that Mandani fella, as someone, you know, I like to discern people's faces a lot. You do know that smile is fake, right? Nobody smiles that much. It's an act. He's an actor, of course, just like the rest of them. And I mentioned Mondani is an 88% favorite on Polymarket. And you might say, well, those are just betting markets. No, they're more than that. Polymarket's accuracy is 95%. Yeah, that's predictive. People putting their money where their mouth is. And that's predicting the future more than any fortune teller or Karl Rove or any economist ever has. What else in the best movie ever? Oh, Obama posted a video of himself talking about Poland and Hungary, two countries in which I've spent a lot of time. And for good reason, I wanted to take my family to a pleasant place. I wasn't going to take them to spend the summer in Western Europe. Not this decade, anyway. I would think the most glorious travel destinations back in the early 21st century would have been, I went to Amsterdam and Paris in 2003. It looks nothing like that now. Prices have skyrocketed. It's not safe. But Eastern Europe, I love. They've been able to retain their cultures through all the migration. They stood up to it, realizing it's unwise and sticking to their guns. Whereas Britain, and they handed over their guns in 97. They banned handguns in 97. So I think the Pakistani gang rapes of young white girls, they must be using knives. I don't know. Wonderful thought, right? Terrible. But Obama put out a video talking about his desire to strengthen democracy in Poland and Hungary. That'd be like a mistress telling the wife she's there to strengthen the marriage. But the Poles are too smart. The Hungarians are too smart for Obama's BS. They see through it. Let's just hope there's no weaponized virus against the people again. That would be real bad. So no telling what communists will do. I'm sure you heard about the supposed racism that was expressed in a group chat comprised of Republican youths. I didn't read all their texts, but I did see where one of them said, "I love Hitler," and Dems, of course, take it literally, which makes sense. Your average leftist would think it's serious because when they talk about killing conservatives, they mean it. So projection strikes again. Oh, an arsonist leftist has been accused of starting the Pacific Palisades fire in California. Back in February, Gavin Newsom was telling the victims of that tragedy that they needed to wake up to the realities of climate change. My comment there is, if the climate was changing when the arsonists set fire to the Pacific coast, then Gavin would be technically correct, which is an argument that sounds ridiculous, but I could see them using that in the future. I don't think anything's too far-fetched for them. It would allow them to say climate change is the reason everything happens, which is, I believe that's what they do with any natural disaster, which of course enables more money laundering. As long as the climate is changing whenever tragedy strikes, which it should be, I'll go ahead and predict that one. Yeah, the climate's going to be changing. I usually like to finish with a Gerwinder, but I feel like there's just too much in the world to cover right now. So let's finish with, I want to talk about the peace deal in the Middle East. One of the things that I love about that is Jared Kushner, when he took the lead on U.S. policy in the Middle East, he was roundly mocked and laughed at by our smug elites who, you know, are quote unquote journalists and pundits. And they specifically mocked him, saying he had read 25 books on the situation in the Middle East, which is such a tell. Of course, they think you're not an expert unless you've been educated as a 19, 20 year old in one of their higher institutions of indoctrination. But reading 25 books on a subject, no, you know, that doesn't matter, right? But that would make you so much smarter than some formally educated quote-unquote expert. How well did experts do with foreign policy before Trump came along? Or how about lifelong politicians and pundits' ability to predict even Trump getting elected in 2016? Or how well did the experts do during COVID? I think the word expert needs its own Jenny Jones makeover. I had a guy who inquired about my weekly coaching program, and he had talked to somebody that I've worked with for years and asked to talk to someone else that I had worked with for many years. and then sent me a text asking specifically, after doing all this background research on me, specifically what was my expertise. You know what I told him? I read a lot. And I haven't heard back. But I do hope he finds the expert who can help him to design a bigger life. I appreciate you listening. If my lack of expertise is something that you feel you could benefit from, hit me up. I'm easy to find online. And I will chat back at you next time. Thank you, folks. God bless y'all.